Let's start off with the Bush administration and some of the appointments we've seen made so far. Colin Powell, for one. The media is starting to tout him now as a lover of peaceful negotiations rather than all-out conflicts.
Well, he certainly was a lover of conflict when he came to the Gulf War. I mean, he didn't end up going all the way, and he did some of it reluctantly. But certainly touting him as a lover of peaceful negotiation is kind of ridiculous. And he's already made it quite clear that I think one of the things this new administration wants to do is make up for the fact that they felt like they let Saddam Hussein get away at the end of the Gulf War. And so I think they'll probably be trying to do some sword rattling over there. They already are. And he's certainly in favor of continuing the sanctions and turning up the heat even more.
Have you heard that Tommy Thompson will be the Secretary of Health and Human Services?
I hadn't heard. I saw that he was probably going to be, but Tommy Thompson is known for leading the way on the rather punitive welfare reform policies, and so I think that that's... you know, that's logical in terms of Bush and his whole philosophy of what's called compassionate conservatism, which I've been doing some thinking about. We're going to be going back to the, you know, to the days of Bush Sr. used to talk about it as 1,000 points of light, and it's really kind of like Scrooge with Christmas lights. So you've got government policies putting more families and working families in homeless shelters and food banks, and then pretending that shelters and food banks are the solution. Bush talks a lot about faith-based programs, faith-based solutions, 1,000 points of light, you know, his father's old rhetoric. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more of the same.
Not exactly a working-class friendly institution that we're looking at.
No, no. I mean, there's no reason to think that at all. I mean, this is an oil man-friendly institution, if anything, oil-friendly administration that is happy talking about things like opening the Alaska Wildlife Refuge to drilling for some short-term gain, not very interested in environmental policies, wanting to study global warming rather than do anything about it. And I think one of the real ways to understand this administration is the new administration coming in is to look at the tax cut that's proposed. You know, George Bush has proposed a giant tax cut. Under his very scuzzy math, you're going to end up with the top 1% of the population getting a much bigger piece of the pie than they have already. I want to return to that in a second. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, the top 1% will get a nice tax cut out of George Bush of about $46,000. That's way more than the typical American's whole yearly income is what the top 1% is going to get in a nice handout. The bottom 20% would get just $42, which would, you know, obviously won't go far and is obviously not a good trade-off there for the damage that it's going to do to the economy, for social programs, and so on. We already have a situation in this country where the top 1% of households have doubled their share of the wealth since the 1970s, doubled their share of the wealth. Top 1% of households already have nearly as much wealth as the bottom 95%. So it's just outrageous right now to be giving the top 1% a giant tax cut.
Let's look at the Forbes 400 and the changes that we've seen over the last few years. First of all, I guess, how has it changed, and why is that a problem for us as Americans?
Well, it's not so much that the problem in the Forbes 400 to me is not so much looking at how has it changed in terms of what kinds of people are coming and going from the list, but rather looking at the overall growth of the wealth of the Forbes 400. For people who haven't had as, you know, much fun as I had reading the Forbes 400, this is Forbes magazine comes out every year with a special issue on the 400 richest Americans. And so that's what's called the Forbes 400. So keep that in mind, 400 people only, richest Americans. Well, you could sock away $1 million every day for a year and a half and still not make the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans. I mean, we are talking an incredible amount of money. Right now it takes, or for just the 2000 list, it's going to go up again next year, it took $725 million just to get on the list, just to get on the list at all, not be the richest person, but get on the list. The Forbes 400 has a total net worth. You know, so you add up all their wealth, you minus all their debts, what do you end up with? You end up with over $1 trillion. Over $1 trillion, which is about one-ninth the total gross domestic product of the United States. If they were themselves a country, they would be almost the world's fifth largest economy. They'd be a little under Great Britain, which is the world's fifth largest economy. I mean, it's an astounding amount of money in the hands of just 400 people. And so this is really this is the tip of the shift that we're talking about to the top 1% that's gone on over the last couple decades and that George W. Bush wants to intensify. And sometimes these numbers get really big. They are really big, and they're hard to conceptualize. So that's, you know, one of the reasons I think you should think about is in terms of, okay, take your $1 million every day, sock it away for a year and a half, and you still don't get to be on the Forbes 400. Well, there's another way to look at it. The top of the Forbes 400 are all billionaires, multi-billionaires. $1 billion is $1,000 million. So if a Forbes 400 member worth $1 billion, just a billion, many of them worth more than that, but take $1 billion, if they give away $1 million, you know, people would give, you know, a lot of fanfare is made up. Oh, they gave away $1 million. That's so great. Well, that is like the typical American family giving away $72, a mere $72. So we're talking about enormous amounts of money and differences in money. And something that's not traditional, in a sense, something that's actually gotten much worse in the last number of decades and something that we need to do something about. Another way to look at this is what's gone on in the gap between workers and CEOs, corporate executives running major corporations. Well, the gap has grown tremendously, tremendously. Corporate executive pay, to quote Business Week, a few years ago, Business Week had a cover, and it said corporate executive pay is out of control. This is Business Week talking, and since then it's gotten a lot worse.
Not exactly a bastion of anti-capitalist thought there either.
No, Business Week being one of the leading business capitalist magazines in the country and internationally. And it has gotten harder to tell CEO paychecks from lottery payouts. The difference is CEOs expect to win big even when the company loses. I mean, it's really phenomenal. You have CEOs making more in a year than their employees will make in a lifetime. And again, some people have gotten used to this, but it's not been always the case. The wage gap between CEOs and workers is now 10 times wider than it was in 1980. In 1980, you had CEOs making 42 times the pay of average factory workers. Last year, they made 475 times as much as workers. And the gap is, I'm sure, going to go up when we get the reports in next year about what's happened for this year. So this is outrageous. So you've got this, what's really a de facto minimum wage in the millions at the top, de facto minimum wage in the millions at the top, and at the bottom of the pay scale, people are supposed to be living on $5.15 an hour. And so you have a minimum wage that's a poverty wage.
Well below poverty.
Well, it is actually. It's a good you say that. I mean, well below the official poverty line. It used to be the minimum wage could bring a three-person family above the official poverty line. And today, minimum wage does not bring a full-time worker with just one child above the official poverty line. And I stress official because the poverty line is actually set much too low. The official poverty line for one adult and one child is under $11,500. So, you know, in fact, it costs much more than that, really, to get by with one adult and one child in this country.
I'm wondering, the wage gap, is it different for men and women?
Oh, absolutely. The wage gap's actually gotten a little worse now. For women, it was getting better for a while, and then it got worse again. The full-time working women earn just 72 cents for every dollar earned by men. 72 cents for every dollar earned by men. You know, and I ask people, do women, you know, go off to the grocery store, buy their health care, housing, child care, whatever it is, and said, you know, here, I'm going to give you 72 cents on the dollar, right, to pay for it? Obviously not. So it hurts. Or you ask yourself, are women worth 28 cents less than a man? I would hope people would answer no. Full-time working women last year earned a median income of about $26,000. Men earned a median income of over $36,000. Their difference between them was over $10,000 a year. So it's not pocket change we're talking about. It's enough to pay rent of over $800 a month and it's nearly the total wages of a full-time minimum wage worker, is the difference between what a median, that is the typical full-time working woman and the full-time working man, earn. And then when you add it up over time, the Institute for Women's Policy Research has looked, well, what does this add up to, you know, over time? Well, the average 25-year-old woman who works full-time until retiring at age 65 will earn over $500,000 less than the average working man, $523,000, over $500,000 less than the average working man by her retirement. So it's a huge, huge, huge amount of money. And I like to quote the business press, so I'll quote you now Fortune Magazine, who talks about the whole issue of discrimination against women, because some people, some people throw out the really ridiculous idea that it's not a problem anymore of discrimination. Our only problem is what they call reverse discrimination, that in fact women are benefiting more than men and so on. Well, it's absurd. Discrimination still exists quite strongly, and so I love this quote from Fortune Magazine because it puts it all in perspective. And so Fortune said, quote, at the same level of management, the typical woman's pay is lower than her male colleagues, even when she has the exact same qualifications, works just as many years, relocates just as often, provides the main financial support for her family, takes no time off for personal reasons, and wins the same number of promotions to comparable jobs, unquote. Now, what's nice about that reflection from Fortune Magazine is that they're knocking down all the myths about why women are paid less even at the highest levels of management. And this all ends up hurting everybody because pay discrimination hurts two-income families who are not getting the same benefit from the second paycheck that they should be, and it's a major cause of poverty for single mothers and their children.
Now, we've seen over the past few years, we've really seen a resurgence in the movement to push for economic equality at many different levels, out on Capitol Hill, in the streets at like WTO and IMF protests, and media outlets such as this one. One of the responses we've seen, at least on the street level, is a resurgence of militarism, which you predicted 20 years ago. How does it feel to have been accurate and predicted that we were going to become more of a police state?
Well, unfortunately, there were a number of things I got to predict some 20 years ago that have borne themselves out. I wrote a book 20 years ago that talked about the Trilateral Commission and elite planning, forecasting what people who were the heads of corporations and heads of banks, heads of multinational corporations, as known more commonly at the time, heads of banks, top academics, government officials, former government officials, where they thought that the U.S. should go if you were thinking from a kind of international corporate perspective, and where they thought the world should go. And so a lot of it was talking about, a lot of it had to do with the shape of the global economy, what people talk about now as globalization. Trilateral Commission and others were working very much for the what they called the reintegration of the Soviet Union, reintegration of China into the global economy. Certainly we've seen that evolve in a way that was more in the direction that I think the people in the Trilateral Commission, people like David Rockefeller, Jimmy Carter, and others imagined, than in a way that many other people were predicting. So they were really at the forefront of continuing to lead. I mean, it was not a new thing even then, but continuing to lead the movement for making the world function best for global corporations. That's really what globalization is about. And so this has been going on for many, many years. In a lot of ways, you can look back and say it's a continuation of what's been going on since colonialism. But in any case, a lot of the predictions from that day have borne themselves out in terms of the intensification of globalization, the hardening of the U.S. government that is being less friendly when it comes to social services and much more unfriendly when it comes to its toleration of protest, for example, when it comes to locking people up. We really lead the world in locking our citizens up. It's quite an outrageous situation, how many people we have behind bars, about 2 million people in jails and prisons in this country. So I think it's very positive now that there has been there have been stronger movements fighting for economic change right now from a more progressive direction. Things like the living wage movement that we have seen both in communities and on campus, and also the anti-sweatshop movement, again, in communities and on campus, is a very, 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 very good things. There are now something like 50 cities with living wage laws in the country and over 80 city and state campaigns that are underway. So it's a movement that has been growing tremendously and says points in a very good direction about where we need to go.
Now, that almost makes me wonder if more companies might choose to go south of the border where they can pay pennies to the dollar here, if they're forced to pay an actual living wage here.
Well, that's one of the reasons why it's so important to talk about things in a kind of both a national and an international way. The original minimum wage in this country was passed in part to prevent a race to the bottom among states. That is, you wanted to set a floor to provide a decent standard of living for people, or an attempt to provide at least a minimally decent standard of living for people. And you also wanted to set a floor so that you would minimize that competition where a company would move from one state that had lower wages to, from a state that had higher wages to a state that had lower wages. And so one of the ways to minimize that competition was by putting a floor in. And that's really something that needs to be done internationally. There's been a lot of talk about that, but we need to get back to it, which is there needs to be whatever it's called, the equivalent of a global minimum wage, which would look very different, you know, in different countries, because countries, what it costs to buy different goods in different countries vary greatly around the world. But the principle is what's important, that you've got to do things that stop the incentives, take away the incentives for corporations to go seeking cheaper and cheaper and cheaper labor. And part of it is you have to say from the top in terms of international government institutions and national government that's not something that we favor. It's not something we're going to encourage, much less, you know, reward with tax incentives and so on as we do now, but rather it's something that's going to be discouraged we need to get to a place where we're saying there really needs to be decent pay for decent work all over the world, not just in the United States. But that's not a reason to not do it here. See, this is the problem. If you allow corporations to continue to say, well, if you don't, you know, that you must have crummy wages and you must have crummy benefits or no benefits. I mean, a lot of people have had their health care plans demolished in corporations that used to pay them. You've had taking away of pensions or no new pensions in corporations and so on. They still move if they think it's in their benefit to move. You can go through different cases where literally unions, for example, or workforces that aren't unionized have given back because they bought into the idea that the corporation wouldn't move if they didn't ask for another raise or if they took a pay cut even, if they got rid of their health care plan, whatever it is, and the company still moves. And what's going on now is companies are moving not just from the United States to a lower-wage country, but from lower-wage third-world countries to even lower-wage third-world countries. So they might be moving from Mexico to Malaysia, from Malaysia to China, and so on. And so this we need a whole host of government statements, the power of persuasion in terms of the principles being put forward by government leaders, as well as we need regulations, we need laws, we need World Bank policies, International Monetary Fund policies, U.S. government policies, export-import bank policies, etc., that discourage that kind of behavior rather than encourage it.
As far as those statements go and those power persuasions, where can they come from to be most effective? Are these processes still controlled by groups like the Bilderberg group, or do we have an effective means of influencing our government, both locally, nationally, and internationally?
Well, we do have some effective means, but they've got to be more effective. I mean, in the United States, the way we're going to have the most effective means of influencing our government is to have better people in government. people with better policies in government. And so you get into kind of a chicken and egg situation that can become a trap, which is many people say to themselves, my government is not, you know, the people in government don't represent me today, and therefore I'm not going to take part in either running for office or voting or whatever it is. And then you end up with people who represent you even less, and the cycle keeps going. And so it's going to take a while. It's going to take some years of saying, I'm going to use every lever that's at my disposal, every democratic lever that's at my disposal. And I think a lot more people need to run for office. I think a lot more people need to make sure they get out and vote. I think that that can end up making a huge difference. Right now we've got two things on the agenda coming out of this last election. One is the continuing to build on the strong majority sentiment in the country for serious campaign finance reform, and to take that to a deeper level and say, you know, put forward the principle that basically democracy is too important to be left up to have money swaying it, and so therefore we need financing, public financing of campaigns, as we have now in some states around the country. We have to have this nationally. We need the mechanisms we've got to look into. That's the other thing that's come out of this election, clearly, is people have gotten a huge wake-up call about how ridiculous the actual machinery of what's supposed to be the machinery of democracy at a basic level, the voting machinery, is around the country. And I think that that is going to end up having a good impact. That is, you're not going to have as big a gap next time around between how people's votes are counted. We have a situation which is really terrible where people who are lower income tend to vote less because they believe the system doesn't represent them, so they tend to turn out less, and also because it's literally harder oftentimes for people with lower income to get to the polls because of the way voting is on a work day and so on. And people don't have as much flexibility in their jobs, don't have as much flexibility in childcare arrangements and so on. So, and then you have what we've learned so much about recently, is then at the polls, low-income communities tend to have the equipment that registers their votes most unfairly, counts them less, and so it compounds the problem. So at any rate, democratic participation, campaign finance reform, all of that is one level, and I urge people to think about that from the same way the right wing does, school board level on up, that this isn't just about who's the president, who's the governor, who's in Congress, who's the senator, but it has to do with who's in the school board, who's in the city council, and so on. But the other thing is, I think it would go a long way towards saying what the U.S. stood for if it would, on the one hand, pass a seriously higher minimum wage, enforce our own, strengthen and enforce our own laws that protect the right to organize, that prohibit discrimination in pay and so on, at the same time as using our muscle power, which is great in institutions, muscle power in the sense of we control often the largest voting blocks in international institutions because of the way the power is distributed, which isn't good actually, but it's often dependent on who pays the biggest chunk of the budget. And also has to do with historical conditions of the U.S. being coming out of World War II with so much power. In any event, it would make a terrific difference if the U.S. was playing a positive role in the International Labor Organization, in the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and so on, the United Nations, rather than a negative role. The U.S. has been, in recent years, part of the problem of actually making regulation, being one that was going to be for less environmental regulation, for less labor regulation, and so on, instead of being one that was going to say, let's take the best things that countries are doing, let's take the best environmental laws in particular countries and make that the standard, rather than lowering environmental laws, for example, around the world. I mean, that's one of the big problems that's gone on, is there's been a what's called harmonizing downward situation, where corporations are basically saying, you know, it's an unfair labor practice or an unfair trade practice if you have a good environmental law, or if you have higher taxes on corporations, and so, or if you have more restrictive policies around minimum, around wages, and so on.
Holly, I want to thank you for the call and the interview today.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.